With March Madness and NCAA now in the spotlight, I reached out to an old friend, New York Times columnist Joe Nocera, for a talk about college sports today. You think he has opinions on the issue? Here are a few highlights. We'll get into the talk right after, starting with a look at some other key issues facing America today.
And I tried to play basketball in college. One of my coaches said I didn't run fast enough to scatter leaves.
Look, they're on campus primarily to generate revenue for the school. They are employees in all but name, and I think they should get paid. If one team decided not to go out for the Final Four and stay in the locker room, that would change the system in about an hour.
Okay, it's my privilege, honor, to invite Joe Nocera to my 21st podcast. Joe, you and I have known each other a long time, and Joe now is a leading columnist for the New York Times, recently wrote a book, which we'll get into later. But we go back to the early 80s, back to the old city service deal, wasn't it?
Where we That's met. Right. Boone, we met 34 years ago in 1982, and I had just come from, I was living in France, actually, and I had just been hired by Texas Monthly to write a story about you. And unbeknownst to me or anybody else at Texas Monthly, you were getting ready to do your first big hostile deal aimed at city service. And I'll never forget sitting in the office of a Houston broker when the ticker, when the news came over the ticker that the fight between Mesa and city service had, was out in the open, was broken in the open, and everybody knew about it. And I spent the weekend worried about how I was going to get to cover this battle. And I finally got you on the phone, and I had all my talking points about how I was going to persuade you. And before I even said anything, you said, "Joe, the play's in New York. What are you doing in Houston?" So I got on the next plane and hung out with you guys for the next 3 weeks while you tried to do this deal.
You know, we kind of did it and kind of didn't. You remember the outcome, of course.
I remember that very well.
You know, there's a story that Burns Hargis, he said, before an audience in Oklahoma City one time, he said, "Could you tell me whatever possessed you to make an offer for city service who were 20 times your size, I'd say closer to 40, but how you could ever do it?" And I told him, "I'm going to tell you a joke, Burns, and the punchline is the answer to your question." And the punchline was, it's the first time we had money. And I won't tell the joke, but it's it was, you know, we did put together enough money to get started on the deal.
Right. And you had two underlying theories, one about the oil and gas business, which was replacing reserves was going to get harder and harder. And the only way you could really do it was to buy another company's reserve. So that was one. But you also, you know, this was the beginning of shareholder activism, what they call now shareholder activism. You know, what they didn't call it such a nice name back then.
I was a corporate raider.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You were a corporate raider. That's right. But, you know, I didn't know anything about business back then. I mean, nothing. And, you know, when I first met you and started hearing you talk about how the shareholders own the company and how corporate management didn't care about the shareholders, they just cared about building their empires, and that the stock price actually matters. It's not an irrelevant factor in running a business. You know, these were all new thoughts to me. I hadn't really heard this ever before in my life. Now, of course, they're completely common conventional wisdom, and I'd love to know your thoughts about this, Boone.
That city service deal, actually, we were such, you know, novices in what we were trying to do that we really didn't. We had a plan. It was a pitiful plan. And, you know, it's interesting because I brought the old investment bankers back and the lawyers about 3 years ago to my ranch, and we spent the weekend going over the deals and was there any one of them, if we'd have known then what we know now, could we have taken over the company? And you know which one we came up with? Only one.
I have no idea.
It was Phillips.
And, oh, right, right.
Yeah, and we would have had to done it. That was in 85. We would have had to done it in a proxy fight. Now, I know you weren't around on that deal. And proxy fights scared the hell out of lawyers and investment bankers. And I didn't know anything about them, so I didn't know whether to be afraid of them or not. But anyway, that was the only one. Let's move on. What today do you think is the biggest business issue facing the country?
Well, you know, in a business sense, I think income inequality is a big business issue, that the middle class jobs are getting hollowed out, that there's a lot of resentment towards how much CEOs make, that companies are profitable, in many cases very profitable, but they're just not adding jobs. And this is especially true in, you know, the Midwest and places where that relied for many, many years on manufacturing. You know, a lot of the presidential candidates, starting with Donald Trump, are running against globalization. I mean, they're basically saying, we're going to shut our borders, we're going to stop China from, you know, stealing or making our products. You can't stop that. It's not going to stop. And the way you got to fix the problem is you got to find ways to employ people in this country to do things that they don't do abroad. I think that is the biggest problem.
Okay. And I agree with you, but I think there's a solution here, or the beginning of a solution, is the fact that the United States has the cheapest energy in the world.
They sure do.
Okay. Cheap energy, I think, trumps cheap labor. But then we run into a problem on labor. If you look at the unemployment on skilled labor, it's everybody's working. Okay, so now we got cheapest energy and skilled labor is all employed. What we need to do is all the other people, make them skilled, and we solve the problem.
Well, sure, but the way to solve, I mean, the way to do that is you have to rejigger your entire education system so that, you know, people who come out of high school unskilled have some skill or go to a community college where they get skills instead of wasting their time. That seems pretty obvious to me.
But if you look at Canada, you know, you come out of high school and you either go to matriculation college or you go to trade school.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's not a bad plan.
No, it's not. And people should, in the United States, should not denigrate trade schools and should actually encourage them. There's some really good things that are happening where companies like General Electric will put a you know, a gas engine plant in North Carolina, and they'll cut a deal with the local community college to teach the skills to the people who are going to work there. We need like a ton more of that.
I see. I'm not big on 4 years college. I think it's too expensive. One, and I'm not sure that it's that good an experience for a young person. What's your thought on that?
I've never really thought about that. I just have always accepted the assumption that 4 years is what people need to get an education. It's a very interesting thought. I've heard a lot of people talk about reducing law school from 3 years to 2 years. But I think that's a very interesting thought. I do, you know, you do need critical skills that you don't get in high school. How to think, how to do certain things. Maybe you don't need 4 years. You know, I also think there's nothing wrong with a broad liberal arts education, especially for somebody who's got the sort of intelligence and background that allow them to get a job without a specialized skill.
That's right. And that's a tricky question, what you just said. But you're a journalist, right?
Last I heard.
You're broad in liberal arts. Right. That goes along with journalism. And I'm a geologist. And so there was a place for us when we got out of school.
Right.
You could get a job, and most of the geologists could. It was slow in 51 when I got out. But the schools need to do a better job of you know, what you're going to see when you leave the university and, you know, go into your career. Because a lot of people today, I mean, they get a college education, can't get a job. And so I think, anyway, let's move on, okay? I think that that's a subject you could take all day, and we probably come up with some pretty good answers. But you wrote the book, Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA.
That's right.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that. We're going to have to go back in history. You know, I can recall very well, you played baseball at Providence, and I tried to play basketball in college, and I wasn't tall enough. I wasn't fast enough. In fact, one of my coaches said I didn't run fast enough to scatter leaves. And how would you like for him to say that to you?
I actually played basketball myself. I've had coaches say things similar to that to me. I was never all that good. But I became passionate about this subject. And look, you know a lot about this because you're deeply involved in college athletics at OSU, at Oklahoma State. And I come at it from a different perspective from you, but I think we both agree that the NCAA is an institution with a lot of problems.
Well, they have a lot of problems, no question. You have recently written a New York Times column suggesting that Connecticut joined the Big 12.
That's right. I am.
That got the attention of the Big 12 people. The Big 12 struggles because they have 10 teams.
That's right.
Yeah, and they play a round robin, and it's not two divisions like the Southeast.
That's right.
Yeah, and I'm not. I like the structure of the Big 12 because you play everybody, and in some cases, in those divisions, where there's divisions, you can play the same team twice. And
well, that's the big disadvantage. If they had a conference championship, you'd have the number one team playing the number two team, and so they're playing each other twice, and it really puts them at a disadvantage. Now, you know, they need to add two teams, and they need to add, I mean, let's face it, this is a business. This is a business. And these guys are making business decisions. That's why West Virginia is in the Big 12, even though they're basically on the East Coast. Connecticut, a team like Connecticut, gives them the New York market and helps them create a Big 12 network. If you think about it from a business point of view, you know, you need 12 teams to have a championship game, to have a better chance to get in the playoffs, which makes you money. And you need some geographic distribution, even though, let's be honest, that's bad for the players.
That's another game for them to have to play.
Well, worse than that, if you're the tennis team in West Virginia and you don't, you know, you don't have a charter jet, you got to take coach to Waco, and then you you know, you drive around to the to Texas and to Texas Tech, and you're out of school for a week and a half. It's not really good for the players, but it's good for the economics of college sports, which is why it happens.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, then there's no question their athletes, men and women both, wouldn't go to college if it wasn't the athletics involved, right?
Well, yeah.
Okay,
sure.
So the athletics then become more important than the academics do. And now what do you have? But
yeah, I'll tell you what you have. You have the tail wagging the dog is what you have.
I know it, but what can you do about it? Is there anything you can do about it?
Yes. Here's what I would do about it. I would accept the fact that football and men's basketball is a big business and has to be done in this national way with Power Five conferences and so on. But you could do everything else like hockey. You could have all the other teams in regional conferences where they can get to each other easily, where the sports are not, don't have the same kind of same big time, overwhelming demands. And you could just sort of, you know, you're not going to change football and men's basketball. You're just not. There's too much money at stake. But you can change the rest of the sports on campus so that it actually becomes, once again, more integrated in the life of the university and less this kind of part of this giant athletic factory.
Okay. Having said that, you've got the minor sports, if you want to call them that, and the major sports.
Right.
And they're both on the campus.
Right.
So you can look at it from a very positive standpoint. Looky what we've got. We've got a major football team, major basketball team, and we have soccer and the baseball and the other sports right here too. Now you're getting into what am I going to school for? If I play the sports, it's obvious. If I don't play the sports, I'm spending an awful lot of time going around watching these games.
Well, you're assuming everybody goes and watches the games, which they certainly don't. Look, there's a lot of people who go to college because they want a big-time sports experience. I've discovered this in the course of working on this book. But, you know, it's not right to say that Ohio State or Oklahoma State doesn't have good academics. In the public mind, sports dominates because that's what people think about and care about. And when there's a college sports scandal, the president of the university has to spend all his time worrying about it. But, you know, these are still really good schools. And the fact that college athletics is drawing people to the school is basically not a bad thing, I think.
And I say that the, you know, the front porch of the university is a football team.
Right, right. And that's why schools do it. I mean, that's why even dinky schools like University of Alabama, Birmingham, which tried to get rid of its football team recently, the president was forced to bring it back. They're never going to be a big-time program. The president was forced to bring it back because the alumni were mad, the boosters were mad, the students were mad, and the city of Birmingham was mad.
Okay.
That's how much this stuff matters.
Sure, it matters. There's no question about it. Football is a big deal. Now, move to the next issue in your book. You want to compensate these people.
I do believe that. I believe that they're short. They get the short end on the education, most of them, many of them. They don't get the education they're promised. I mean, we have things like that terrible, terrible scandal at the University of North Carolina where they had fake classes for 20 years to keep athletes eligible. And they're on campus primarily to generate revenue for the school. That's why they're there, football and men's basketball players. They make money for the school. They are employees in all but name. And I think they should get paid. I absolutely do. Do I think they should get millions of dollars? No, I don't. That would break the university. But I do think that they deserve compensation well beyond what they're getting now, which is a scholarship and a little money called the differential between the scholarship and the full cost of attendance. I think they should get more than that.
Everybody's got to get the same thing, though. You agree with that?
No, I don't, actually. So here's my thought about that. I went to Boston University, Boone, because they gave me the most scholarship money. So I was able to factor money. Money was a part of my decision on where I went to school.
Well, wait a second, Joe. Make it clear that was academic, not athletic.
Well, sure it was. But, you know, if you're trying to get an athlete to come to your school, why not offer? Look, we have this sleazy recruiting world now with under the table payments and you know, pseudo agents steering players to here and there and AAU coaches being paid off. The system would be much cleaner if you said, come to my school, sign a 3-year contract, I'll pay you $40,000 a year.
And that means that if you're in the Big 12, everybody has to pay $40,000, right?
No, because Ohio. Let me make this a little more complicated. I don't believe the NCAA should be in the business of setting compensation. I think the amateur rules are bogus and are just basically a cartel suppressing the wages of the labor force. That's what I think. So it seems to me there's two ways you can come at this. One is you could do a salary cap where, you know, everybody gets the same amount of money and maybe there's a little left over to go out and negotiate with a star player that you want to get, and somebody else would have a similar negotiation. Or you could have the conferences set the compensation for each conference, which is a unit that would pass the antitrust smell test, and it would infuse some market, you know, some market forces into what is a business in every other way.
I'm not a factor, and probably will not be a factor in making a decision like this, but I would go with a salary cap.
Okay.
I think that's, and it's already, it apparently works in the professional football. Why wouldn't it work here? And it's, they've been over and gotten the bad parts out, made changes and take advantage of their experience and use it for college football. You right. might do it for a period, you know, of 4 years, and then decide whether you want to proceed or not proceed, too.
I'll tell you something else that's going on out there. You know, they have this new thing called cost of attendance, where they pay the players a check. They've cut the players a check. That's supposed to be the difference between the scholarship and the actual cost of attendance. Well, you know, Alabama, their cost of attendance used to be $3,000. You know what it is now? It's over $6,000. So they're actually already using money as a means to attract players. They're just not calling it a salary, but they're raising the cost of attendance amount so they can say, hey, we pay more than Auburn, or we pay more than Michigan. And that is becoming a factor. It's already happening.
Yeah, so you're saying there should be some organized plan.
Yeah.
Not trying to figure out how to circumvent what you have to work with.
Right, right. Well, I do believe a lot of the rules should be just blown up in the 400-page rule book. But, yes, in terms of the actual compensation, you know, I think you need a plan. I think you need a system, and it shouldn't be this underhanded, tricky way that it is now.
Okay, now what do we have to do to can you and I rule on this?
We cannot.
I need to be the one to call Oklahoma State and tell them what I've done.
Well, the problem, Boone, is that even though the courts in the last few years have ruled that the NCAA's amateurism rules violate the law, they violate the antitrust law, the judges aren't willing to take the obvious next step. If the rules are against the law, you should get rid of the rules, right? That's kind of what happens, but not in college sports. So you've had these cases where the rules have been shown to violate the law. It's been actually upheld on the Court of Appeals. It could wind up going to the Supreme Court, right? But the courts have been unwilling to take the rules away. So even though the rules violate the law, they still exist, and the NCAA still is allowed to set compensation for players. That's why you and I could agitate all we want, but it's not going to change until, well, I'll tell you what could change it. Pretty simple. If one team decided not to go out for the Final Four and stay in the locker room, that would change the system in about an hour.
If the team wouldn't play,
that's right.
What would they say they weren't? The reason they didn't play? Oh, it was because the players weren't paid.
Yeah, because they go on strike.
Okay, so that that makes sense. I agree with you.
You know, it almost happened. You know, it almost happened in 1991. UNLV was going to not come out for the championship game that year. They had the only coach in the country who would support that, who was Jerry Tarkanian.
I know Jerry. I think Jerry died, didn't he?
He did. He died last year.
Yeah, good guy. I knew him. I got to know him. He had West Coast connections, and I did too. And anyway, a nice guy, a really nice guy.
He fought the NCAA in court for 20 years. But his team was going to boycott the final game, but then they lost to Duke in the semifinals, so it never happened.
That would have been something would have happened if the team didn't come out on the floor for the final game.
So, something would have happened.
We weren't supposed to agree on this, but the more I thought.
You know, when we first met, Boone, when I was 29 and you were 52 or 53, you said to me, you said, Joe, I know you're a liberal from the Northeast, and I'm going to teach you that we conservatives aren't so bad.
What did I teach you?
You pretty much taught me that. But, you know, you also taught me a lot about capitalism and the free market, and I'm applying those ideas now to this thing called college sports.
And I think it's a good idea, Joe. Well, what I'm going to, Joe, I want to tell you, we probably provoke some real thinking here on this subject. And I encourage all of our listeners to buy Indentured, the Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA, written by Joe Nocera. And I do get, what do I get? Some royalty on this, don't I?
Oh, you get half the proceeds, bro. No question.
Okay, Joe. Thank you. Let's do this again sometime.
It was totally fun, Boone.